Young, it's here and now. This morning in his year-end news conference, President Bush said that he believes the U.S. is going to win in Iraq, that he hasn't made up his mind yet about whether more troops are needed there. And when asked whether he questioned his decision to remove Saddam Hussein, he said no. One reporter asked Bush about the latest CBS News poll.
50% of Americans say they favored a beginning of an end to U.S. military involvement in Iraq. 43% said keep fighting, but change tactics. Yeah. By this and many other measures, there is no clear mandate to continue being in Iraq in a military form. I guess my question is, are you still willing to follow a path that seems to be in opposition to the will of the American people?
I am willing to follow a path that leads to victory. And that's exactly why we're conducting the review we are.
Dimitri Sefistopoulos, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times of London. He joins us now. And Dimitri, what jumped out at you about the president's tone or what he said today?
Well, Robin, I thought it was very interesting when he was asked why he had given up his rhetoric from October when he said that the U.S. was absolutely winning in Iraq. Today he said, we're not winning, we're not losing. But he still talked about victory. And then he was asked whether he would overrule his military generals in the Pentagon. The Joint Chiefs of Staff are said to be opposing a surge in troops in Baghdad because they don't believe it would have a positive effect. Mr. Bush was asked whether he would overrule that advice, and he sidestepped that question. So on the one hand, he's saying that the U.S. people want to see a new policy in Iraq. On the other hand, he's saying he still wants to see victory, and there seems to be a more growing discord between those two ideas.
Well, we're wondering, the president did say to the Washington Post last night, we're not winning, but also not losing. And did you get a sense today that he felt the need to retract the first part of that, the we're not winning part?
Yeah, I think anytime he's asked tough questions about that, he tries to retract it. But, I mean, he made the comments he made yesterday basically referring to General Peter Pace, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who's used that formula recently. It's a way to say things are not going very well in Iraq, but we don't think that we're losing. We still can be successful. And clearly Mr. Bush has to say to the American people that whose support is declining and is very, very low for the war, that while you may not support what we're doing right now, we're going to put in a new policy. We think it'll work. We think we can be successful, and we would like you to support what we're doing. And I think that as the commander-in-chief, that's the only thing he can do until he decides otherwise, that he decides he needs to pull out of Iraq, if that's what indeed happens.
The president was also asked some reflective questions today. One mentioned that Lyndon Johnson had trouble sleeping during the Vietnam War, and President Bush was asked if he had any painful realizations himself. And he was also asked if he's looking at, as you said, how the U.S. got into the position it's in now in Iraq. What did he say?
Well, it's interesting. Today, he seemed very uncomfortable with that question. He talked a little bit about the pain he has when he talks to families who have lost sons and daughters in Iraq. But he put a caveat in there. He said, but when he talks to them, they always say that they want the mission be successful so that the lives of their sons and daughters have not been taken in vain. So he's trying to walk, a narrow line between these two things. He said previously that he has no problem sleeping and people will be surprised at how well he sleeps, which it may be physiologically an accurate statement. It probably doesn't sound very well to the American, sound very good to the American people.
Well, Dimitri, I know this isn't your beat, but we noted the president was also asked about the baby that Mary Cheney, the vice president's lesbian daughter, is having with her female partner. And he replied to one question that he said the law ought to be reviewed to make sure people should be treated fairly. And this is in terms of hospital rights. So some people will find that of interest. But the most questions were about the Iraq war and troops. And just before we let you go, when asked about the debate over a surge in troops, again, the Joint Chiefs said to be against it, the White House leaning towards it, the president responded, there must be a specific mission that can be accomplished. From your vantage point, how do you read that? And are there troops that may be available for a surge?
I think the general consensus is there's about 20,000 troops available for a short-term surge, but nothing more than that, and the surge would be 3 to 6 months. To me, what was most fascinating about that statement it seemed to closely mirror what General Colin Powell, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs and Mr. Bush's Secretary of State for the first 4 years of his presidency, said over the weekend, which is that if you're going to do something like that, you need to have a specific mission. You need to know what you want to accomplish, whether it can be accomplished, and whether you have the number of troops to do it. General Powell concluded that the U.S. doesn't have the number of troops to do that. So I was quite struck by that, and whether it's possible President Bush is coming around to the view of the Joint Chiefs, but we'll have to wait until January to see what he ultimately decides to do.
Dimitri Sevastopoulou, a Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times of London. Dimitri, thank you as always.
Thank you, Robin. Bye.
Well, our next guest is focusing on the other war, the one in Afghanistan. Anthony Cordesman is senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He says the U.S. and NATO are in danger of losing the war against the Taliban, al-Qaeda, and other Islamist movements in Afghanistan. And he came to his conclusion after a recent trip there. His op-ed piece about that trip appeared recently in the New York Times, and he joins us now with more. Anthony Cordesman, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And to the country. You cited several trends and numbers that helped you come to this conclusion, and they were some pretty disturbing numbers.
Well, they're disturbing because what you've seen between 2005 and 2006 is a massive increase in Taliban and other Islamist attacks, and in the areas where they're attacking. Now, it's important to note these aren't my figures and they're not really my conclusions. They're declassified U.S. intelligence, and when you look at it, you see something like a fourfold increase in attacks on Afghan forces, on U.S. and other coalition forces. But I think most importantly, you see between a four- and five-fold increase in the areas in Afghanistan where there are serious incidents and a major Taliban presence. When you see a increase that really leads to major engagements, as we did in 2006, where you had at least three major fights between U.S. forces and Taliban forces in the east. When you see the kind of clashes in the south where the British are forced into a compromise, where they have to cede substantial amounts of territory to the Taliban, this is what really counts. And unfortunately, what we often see are estimates of fighters, which have no credibility, and then a focus on the number killed rather than the areas controlled, the numbers wounded, or the numbers intimidated.
And why is that, though? Why are numbers intimidated? Why were the British forced out? What is it about the fighting?
I think we need to understand there never really was a major Afghan presence in the field. The government has always been somewhat remote in Kabul, particularly in the Pashtun areas. This has always been something where tribal control existed. There really was very little funding of a major nation-building effort. There was far too much focus on democracy, on elections, on the government in Kabul. People didn't attempt to provide services or support in the districts, in the provinces, and at the local level. They created essentially a vacuum. And for the people in Afghanistan, after decades of war, they desperately needed aid in very simple forms: roads, water, power, schools, medical services. The government, however, was never given the support or the aid it needed to build up real capability. And Kabul became essentially a center of inefficiency and corruption. At the same time, there were never enough NATO or U.S. aid workers to really make a significant difference, and whole areas were left empty for the Taliban to come back into.
Well, in that way, the lack of services, and as you just were saying before that, the spike in violence, Afghanistan sounds so much like Iraq, and yet you write that it's, in many ways, very different from Iraq, including the most distinct one, which sounds like it is the most distinct one, in that there are so many Afghans who are hoping that the U.S. will have a solution.
Well, I think they're really hoping that their own government has a solution. But when you visit the capital, you find out very quickly that even ministers will say corruption is something that can't be cured in a few years. There are a handful of competent governors and district chiefs. You just are beginning this year to create the facilities for an adequate Afghan police force. The Afghan army was never given the funding and support necessary to really expand. So what you saw was a situation where you created a vacuum. Now, the Taliban is not popular with many tribes, and certainly a majority of the Afghan people. They can remember quite well all of its abuses. But when you have nothing in place, when you leave this kind of vacuum through neglect, through trying to push what essentially is a war the U.S. has to win, off on allies which don't make the kind of commitments you need, you create a power vacuum where even a weak force can have a major influence and begin to control part of the countryside.
You say one deputy minister told you, now we are all corrupt, meaning the entire Afghan government, and until we change and serve the people, we will fail. But I want to make sure I understand something I thought you wrote, going back to the idea that this is, in Afghanistan, different from Iraq, in that I thought you wrote, popular support for the U.S. and NATO teams has been strong and can be rebuilt.
Well, that is certainly true, but it's support for NATO, and it is support for the U.S. as a bridge to creating local authorities. One thing we have to understand, no one wants an occupier. No one wants a liberator to stay. But what people do want is the kind of U.S. and NATO aid effort that can really help the Afghans in nation building, that will create the kind of government and government services they need. And one thing you become aware of in Afghanistan, as you do in Iraq, is the American and Western interest in democracy is something which, for most people, has very little meaning, because from a day-to-day viewpoint, what people want are jobs, they want security, they want basic services, and they see us as a bridge to getting those. So this is a period of transition, and I think we need to understand that. To make this work, it isn't a matter of simply strengthening our capabilities. We have to show that we are creating effective Afghan capabilities.
I want to find out more what you conclude are the solutions to the situation in Afghanistan. But first, I just want to ask you, Anthony Cordesman, you were just in the country. You said you did get to see declassified intelligence. But I'm wondering, what did you see with your own eyes on the ground? I mean, what do you see as an analyst?
You visit a police unit and you find out not only is it only paid quarterly, but it hasn't been paid for the last quarter. And yes, the police unit goes out and takes things. It has to survive. You visit an Afghan army unit and you meet some very brave soldiers, but they've been in service for 3 years. They were thrown into combat too soon. And their U.S. advisor tells you that out of this group, only about 20% are going to reenlist, and their reenlistment period is coming up shortly. You meet a deputy minister of interior who lays out for you why the economic situation is so critical, why so few Afghans can actually live on their government salary. You don't see fighting, but you overfly the south. You see the collapse of the irrigation system that worked for thousands of years. You see the impact of drought. You see road systems that don't work. And people that have no choice, they can't eradicate drugs, because the only crop they can use to survive is narcotics, which adds up to about one-third of the annual income per capita of all of Afghanistan. These are things that do become apparent very quickly.
Anthony Cordesman, Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We heard earlier today President Bush saying that victory is achievable in Iraq. Anthony is saying that the chance for victory may be slipping in Afghanistan. He's just returned after a visit to that country. When we come back, so what are the solutions? More troops, more money, more NATO troops, more U.S. troops. Much more with Anthony Cordesman. And a reminder a little later, the cost of search and rescue here in the U.S., who should pay? Much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Anthony Cordesman, Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's just returned from an extensive trip to Afghanistan. He says there's a very real risk the U.S. and NATO could lose the war there. So, Anthony Cordesman, what needs to happen in Afghanistan? We just saw Arizona Senator John McCain in Kabul over the weekend making the demand we've heard before that the NATO allies that have restrictions against their troops doing combat in the more dangerous areas, that they lift those restrictions and step up to the plate and do more of the actual fighting. What do you make of that debate?
Well, what are the things that people there want? First, NATO commanders, and indeed some of the commanders of the forces that aren't allowed to fight and participate, fully support what Senator McCain said. There has to be an integrated NATO command. Everybody has to make a contribution where NATO can assign forces where they're needed, and forces can be put into combat. And in fact, one country has changed its position just in the last few days, and that's France. which has greatly increased the flexibility in using its forces. The British clearly need reinforcements. It's very hard for their officers to say this at a time when they're also tied down in Iraq, but they certainly need about a 50% increase in British manning in the zones where they're operating to do anything with sufficient flexibility so they don't have to depend on some kind of tribal compromise with the Taliban. U.S. commanders will say we only have about half the infantry battalions we really need to secure the area and deal with the threat we face, and they need a major increase in special forces. But I think the most important thing is we've provided almost no real aid relative to need. The country team has gone in and it's requested an increase of about 3 times in the security assistance aid. The economic aid needs to basically be about 3 to 4 times what it's been. And these increases in aid not only have to be U.S. support, but they have to come from other countries. Right now, this issue is being decided in Washington. Evidently, at least the military aid may be provided. There's real resistance within OMB to providing the basic economic aid that would support military operations in the field. So one problem we have in talking to our allies is we haven't set much of an example. We're not doing what we should be doing either.
Anthony Cordes, when you write that these problems have been somewhat off the radar because of the problems in Iraq, what do you think? Do you think the U.S. and coalition forces is on the brink of losing not one but 2 wars?
I think it is certainly possible. Now, when you say the brink, I don't think we're talking about something that will happen overnight. But one of the problems we have is a confusion between being able to win battles tactically, which we can do in Iraq as well, and win strategically, which requires us to win politically and economically and in developing an effective set of Afghan capabilities, in denying Taliban and other extremist movements the ability to occupy space and take over broad areas, and deal with the problem of narcotics in ways which win popular support, don't simply rush in with eradication. We have probably 2 years in which to act. And one thing that I think easily gets lost is that these aid requests, troop deployments, all the rest take time. This is December. In about 3 to 4 months, a new fighting season is going to begin in Afghanistan. You can rush troops in, but you can't give them instant experience. In a long war, it can take years to develop effective Afghan governance. If all the aid money were voted by the Congress when it comes back into session, it still would be the summer of next year, the mid-offensive period before the money was actually available and the new aid activities started. We need to develop a sense of time. We keep talking about long wars, but we want instant solutions, and they simply can't happen.
Well, Anthony Cordesman, what can be done in the short term, before spring, when the next Taliban offensive might begin? Are there things that would help between now and then?
Changing the rules on NATO troops would provide immediate support. You can bring in U.S. reinforcements. That would help a great deal in the East. Even the promise of aid, the start of programs, token activity that is shown in the villages, in the areas where the Taliban is active, can at least dominate the information battle and persuade people they have a reason to reject the Taliban, to trust in the future. So no, it's not a matter that nothing can be done, but we do need to understand the timelines between simply approving a change and actually being able to execute it. And we also need to understand that even in peacetime, restructuring and rebuilding failed states generally takes 10 to 15 years, not 2 or 3. And that simply holding elections is a kind of empty political gesture until you develop meaningful governance.
Anthony Cordesman, one last question. We've talked to you over several years now. How disheartening was your trip, and is this a conclusion to you?
I don't think it was disheartening. I think it was a trip in which people were very frank, where it was impressive to see they clearly understood the problems, These are in many cases people who understand nation building and warfare. It's a very impressive U.S. team and NATO command team. They have good, well-articulated plans. Unlike Iraq, the aid team is capable of absorbing the money and has the right priorities. The problem here is not the need for some dramatic new strategy, although one issue is Pakistan. It is really giving the war the attention and the resources necessary to win it. We've got, as a nation, to show that we can both walk and chew gum. And if we're going to fight two wars at once, we have to actually fight two wars at once.
Dr. Anthony Cordesman, Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, switching gears a bit. Tomorrow on Here and Now, what's the size of your environmental footprint in this season of consumer consumption? Also, pop diva Beyoncé gets upstaged by an American Idol runner-up, the new movie Dreamgirls. That's all tomorrow. And coming up today, the cost of rescue on the mountain. Stay with us. Much more ahead Here and Now. Funding from Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There's more bad weather in the forecast for Oregon's Mount Hood, where two climbers have been missing on the snowy mountain for 12 days. The body of their companion, Kelly James, was recovered on Sunday. The search for the missing climbers has renewed a debate over whether climbers and others who engage in what some might call risky activities should have to reimburse governments for the costs of rescuing them. Only two states, Oregon and Colorado, and one county in Utah, have provisions for reimbursements. They seek them only in cases where the rescuee was negligent, say went up without equipment, and it's usually just a $500 fine. Some ski resorts also charge thousands of dollars for rescues if you go outside designated areas. But mostly, the tab for search and rescue missions is picked up by government and volunteer organizations. Well, joining us now is Randy Service. He's president of the National Association for Search and Rescue, a Virginia-based group that educates and trains rescue workers. And Randy, first of all, your thoughts on the Mount Hood search. I imagine all searches are tough, but this one seems to have been really tough.
Yes, it has. It's these type of missions are always tough on the rescuers and the family members. You tend to get emotionally attached to the task at hand of rescuing somebody. It's probably one of the highest honors and one of the most emotional events that you can have in your lifetime. And when the events turn the way this one has, where we do have one fatality, it does emotionally affect you.
Well, and there are other impacts as well. As we said, that's, of course, the most important one. But let's talk about the costs. I understand there's no bill. There's no one bill with a bottom total. But how much, roughly, does a rescue operation such as this one cost local, state, county, federal governments and agencies a day?
Well, the costs are real hard to calculate, but I can give you some examples. Black Hawk helicopters run at about $5,000 an hour. The Chinook helicopter is running a lot more than that. And then the C-130 that was brought in also has a substantial hourly cost. And so those costs are picked up by the state or federal government because those are state or federal assets. The more technical the asset that is used on a search and rescue, the higher the cost. Manpower costs, which we typically think of, are really an implicit cost because most of the manpower used on a search and rescue are volunteer resources. They don't cost the government, but they do cost the individual volunteer or his employer for him to be involved.
We understand there's another consideration on the part of rescuers such as yourself, that you'd be afraid that if someone thought there was going to be a cost they'd have to pay to get rescued, they may delay in sending out a signal that they're lost.
Yes, and that's a real concern. We have seen that there is a misnomer out there that search and rescues cost, and we have seen people delay requesting for assistance. And the fear is that if they delay the request, that we will end up having to put searchers and rescuers in more dangerous and hazardous situations, or we may end up finding the individuals deceased.
We understand there was once three college kids who got lost on Mount Hood and cost the taxpayers $10,000, and they were found playing cards. They didn't have cell phones. They didn't have radio locator beacons. They weren't prepared. And I'm just wondering, do you think it should be required that people who are going for the big climbs have locator beacons?
Personal locator beacons are a phenomenal piece of technology, and what that does is it takes the search out of search and rescue. We now know where an individual is within a quarter of a mile, and it really limits the time and the manpower that are needed to find somebody. So I highly recommend that people that are going to be in wilderness areas or areas of extreme weather or complex topography, they should have a personal locating beacon.
Yeah.
The advantage of that is it goes through the satellite systems and not through the cell phone systems, and allows us to locate somebody fairly quickly.
Randy Service again with the National Association for Search and Rescue. You're also a climber. And I'm
yes,
just
ma'am.
Wondering, I know that there's, you know, climbers quake when something like this happens, not just for you know, the tragedy involved, but also the stigma that they know goes with it. We've talked quite a bit to Dave Roberts, a terrific climber who's written a book about how he had second thoughts about a climb like even Mount Hood, that, you know, it's just too risky and it puts other people in a terrible position if he's to get lost. And that's a conclusion he came to. When something like this happens, do you rethink these kinds of winter climbs at such altitudes? I mean, or is it too infrequent to deter a real climber?
I think all of us in the search and rescue business, when something like this happens, it really comes close to home. We see other experts, other experienced people get in trouble, and it reminds us how fragile our own lives are and how a cascade of judgments can come back and get you. And so I think that's a reminder to us in the search and rescue profession, and we do take it at heart. Where I think you have a point is the general public. When these events are an irregular event, they tend to forget in the future. And so I'm sure climbers over the next 6 months to maybe 9 months to a year will think about Mount Hood and look at what they're doing and factor that into their judgments. 3-4 years from now, it will have been forgotten. And I think that you will then begin to see people not thinking about it.
Do you think the three men who went on Mount Hood, and again, it's speculation based on some evidence that I know you rescuers have, but do you think they did something foolish? Do you think that they were prepared?
I think that what happened is something that happens. It's called a cascade effect, where one judgment in and of itself was not a bad judgment or a poor judgment, but the next judgment that was built upon, and you keep going down this road, will eventually add into a devastating event. And we see that with aircraft pilots, people driving cars. And so it's really hard to say, not knowing exactly what the judgments were. We had somebody get injured and in this event, and that's what started a cascade of decisions that ended in a fatality. We don't know how somebody got injured here, and that in and of itself may have just been an accident.
Randy Service, president of the National Association for Search and Rescue, on whether people in the outdoors should have to pay for, you know, rescue efforts. And, of course, I'm thinking in Oregon, there was another story recently, the poor Kim family, all they did was take a turn down a road where the gate should have been closed, and found themselves in need of rescue. So it's hard to be critical.
Yes, ma'am. We can all make mistakes, and I think it's more risky sometimes just driving to work some days.
Randy, thanks.
You're welcome.
You never know. Still to come, some jazz to underscore the holidays. You're listening to Here and Now. How would you illustrate your faith? Boston artist Clara Wainwright asked herself that question after 9/11, and she came up with the Faith Quilts Project, an exhibit of 57 large quilts made by volunteers from the Boston area. The quilts were put on display earlier this year, and Here and Now's Lynn Menegon filed this report.
For me, I personally think, you know, I'm not going to be the same person.
Sudad Jamte was invited to create a quilt along with other Hindu parents at her child's Montessori school. Like other groups in the Faith Quilts Project, they had a leader who had received training in how to talk about sensitive issues.
She said, talk about, I feel more Hindu when, and finish the sentence, like a homework. So we're all sitting quietly, finishing our piece. And it was amazing because each of us here thought different things, and then when we put that together, a common thread evolved. And we all said, you know, we cared about respect to elders was a very big theme. And one another theme was that we coexist with nature, with animals. I didn't realize what I was doing. I was like teaching my daughter, you have to feed birds, you have to do this, do that. I didn't even realize I was doing that. So one sentence was that. The other thing was, what do you want to give to your kids? And we never even got to the second sentence. By this time, we were, you know, full with that topic.
The quilt that the group produced is filled with images of light, children and elders, animals, all surrounding the symbol of Om, which is the sound of life. And Sudha saw similarities between her quilt and other quilts.
It's about people. And I see that when I walk through all the quilts, I feel like I could have done any of them. I kind of relate to every one of them.
Faith Quilts Project Artistic Director Clara Wainwright, who says her faith resides in art, describes another quilt that she helped members of the Vineyard Christian Fellowship of Cambridge create.
We had gone out to a fabric store and we had bought all these beautiful silks and brocades. But this one woman brought in two flannel shirts that had belonged to her father. And she said, I would really like to include something of my father's shirts in this quilt. And people sort of looked at her and didn't respond in any particular way. And I said, well, just, you know, keep them in, we'll see. When we finally got down to working on the quilt, Julie, who owned the shirts, she threw that shirt down. It both looked like a cross, and it looked like the shirt of a working man. And it was amazing, because this entire group of women suddenly had a huge thought change, and they saw that this represented Jesus, who was a carpenter, and Jesus, who was a common man, and it was like this group epiphany. I mean, it was an amazing moment.
Wainwright also told the story of a homeless man named Neff, who helped make a quilt with the Boston Rescue Mission.
He wrote something that the woman who was the lead quilter on this project read, and it said, you know, for 25 years, I was an evil man and I lived on the streets, which were full of evil. But at a certain point, God came to me and gave me strength, and I found the mission. And I have been clean now for 4 months and I'm in school. Well, it was the most amazing thing.
And Neff's contribution topped his quilt. The image of wings protecting the rescue mission, which is depicted as the only building on the Boston skyline glowing with welcome. Birds are also stitched into a quilt that round-faced teenager Yasmin Saleh made for her mosque. It shows doves flying from a huge golden sun in the center.
One day, Clara asked the whole group to imagine a picture that would be a quilt, and I just saw birds being prophets, because in Islam we really don't draw prophets or God, so they use the bird idea.
Only one quilt was being made at the exhibit. It was for Yasmin's unfinished mosque, which has been controversial. On the quilt, Yasmin's doves fly over the mountains to the city of Boston. People at the exhibit were invited to sit down and sew together the cloth buildings. Yasmin's mother explains why.
It's connecting the message of Islam really to the whole world, that we're not a separate part. We need to interact with others and cooperate with others and be responsible for the world that we live in.
Faith Quilts, made in the past year by Boston area volunteers. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Young, It's Here and Now. Guitarist Jim Hall's version of O Tannenbaum. If you'd like to deck the halls with Jim Hall or the music of other fine jazz artists this holiday, Here Now jazz aficionado James Isaacs is here with his holiday gift picks. James, welcome.
Season's greetings, Robin.
And you have a big ticket item to start us off.
Absolutely. I have from the King of the Hill, the top of the heap, nobody else but the chairman of the board himself, Francis Albert Sinatra. This is a handsomely packaged, exceptionally remixed 4-CD and 1-DVD boxed set from Reprise and Rhino Records. Its title, Sinatra Vegas.
And can we assume these are recordings from the casino shows there?
They are indeed. These performances, all 88 of them, are previously unreleased Sinatra performances. And there's also on the DVD 19 selections. All of the material was recorded between 1961 and 1987.
So we know you feel this is some of Frank Sinatra at his best, and we want to hear it. But first, how should we listen to it?
Well, Robin, one particularly interesting aspect of this set is that the listener gets to know both Sinatra and Frank.
What do you mean?
Well, you see, to me, Sinatra is the great concert artist whose vocal timbres, his sustained tones, his impassioned lyricism, and singular interpretive gifts have often been likened to cellist Pablo Casals, or Miles Davis, or Sir Laurence Olivier. Sinatra is deadly serious about his definitive artistry, and when Frank takes over, especially in Vegas, the drinks and the laughs are on him.
You know, if you've seen us perform before, seen me perform before, that we try to inject a little touch of this kind of song. So we call it a saloon song. I have a great reverence towards saloon songs because I've been singing them in more saloons than any other singer I've ever known in my life. And I've had torches so high I burned down buildings. Yes, get that bum out of here.
The 1961 take of Cole Porter's Just One of Those Things from Sinatra Vegas shows us both sides. Two for the price of one. But once Frank steps aside and Sinatra reigns supreme, we are rewarded with the gem of this set. Sinatra knew exactly how to make his voice flutter just enough to very poignant effect. And usually, Robin, Just One of Those Things is taken at either a jaunty tempo or at a flag-waving tempo way up. Not here. It's a ballad, and it's as tender as nearly anything Sinatra ever sang in his lengthy career.
It was just one of those things. Just one of those crazy flings. One of those bells that now and then rings. It was one of those things. It was just one of those nights. Just one of those fabulous flights. A trip to the moon on gossamer wings. It was one of those things.
Okay, so from Sinatra in Vegas, and by the way, we'll have all of the recommendations at our website, here-now.org. From Vegas, we go where?
Well, in point of fact, we go to Belgium. We're going there to hear Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. We're going to change the groove entirely, as we do indeed turn to drummer, band leader Art Blakey. This is from a recently released DVD called Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, live in 58. And this is part of a series of individual titles from the Jazz Icons label. All of the material is by top-notch players and singers, either in concert or on television between 57 and 58. I'll give you like three names: Chet Baker, Dizzy Gillespie, Ella Fitzgerald. The video transfers and sound reproduction, both excellent. And in some cases, like on the Blakey disc, the DVDs spotlight bands whose creative lives as working units were not terribly long. As an example, for more than 40 years, Art Blakey, maybe the most powerful small group drummer in all of jazz, led many editions of the Jazz Messengers, but this particular group didn't exist for an extended period of time.
Thank you. That's Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers featuring, by the way, a 20-year-old Lee Morgan, who just
a phenomenal player at that young age, yeah.
Yeah, plays the trumpet. And that's the DVD Live in 58.
And again, Robin, all of the DVDs in this first batch from Jazz Icons are worth owning. The packaging, the photos, the liner notes, and, of course, the music, all formidable.
Okay. Now, you want to tell us about a box set that is just CDs, though, which is that?
Yeah, strictly CDs. Prestige just put out some first-rate packages for this holiday season. My pick, Sonny Stitt. Stitt's Bits, the Bebop Recordings 1949 to 1952 is the title. And this title is slightly misleading, Robin, because bebop isn't all you'll hear in this exceptional collection by a musician who was in some ways not so much underrated, but taken for granted because he was such a monstrous technical player on alto, tenor, and to a lesser extent baritone saxophone. Because Edward Sonny Stitt was maybe the first and best known of the saxophonists who in the 1940s came up after Charlie Parker, he was dismissed in some quarters as a very talented imitator. Not true. Read the wonderfully adamant and at times even confrontational liner notes to this set by Harvey Pekar of American Splendor fame. They'll set you straight.
So we have reading material as well, but there are 76 cuts from Stitt. What would you like to hear?
Well, I'm going to take us back to 1949 to hear Sonny Stitt doing his Lester Young swing meets bebop bit. Stitt's playing the tenor saxophone. He leads a quartet with the brilliant pianist Bud Powell. The drummer's Max Roach. The tune is All God's Chillin' Got Rhythm. And maybe you remember this number, some of you anyway, from the 1937 Marx Brothers movie A Day at the Races. This version is Off to the Races, Sonny Stitt Quartet.
Late saxophone master Sonny Stitt from a 3-CD anthology, Stitt's Bits.
Mm-hmm.
And just before we let you go, James, 'tis the season and you have some sounds.
I do, Robin. And this is a single disc, absolutely ideal for sitting by the fire, enjoying a snifter of cognac or brandy at the end of the long day. The album's called Christmas Break, Relaxing Jazz for the Holidays.
And that's dangerous. That's dangerously close to smooth jazz.
No, not smooth. Just relaxing, easy swing with some really good players all on the Telarc Records label, including Oscar Peterson, Jim Hall, Mel Torme, George Shearing, Al DiMeola, and Jeannie Bryson.
DVDs, CDs, and the relaxing jazz that we're listening to right now. We'll have it all on our website, here-now.org. James, the happiest and most relaxing of holidays to you.
And to you, Robin. And to the listeners, happy holidays.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.